turning them around and upside down, sniffing the bags of coffee beans, poking at the straws and napkins. Then he found the spices. She caught up with him at the condiment stand just as he was slipping the little jars of cinnamon and chocolate in the pocket of his running pants.
"What are you doing?"
she whispered, removing the lids from their coffee. She angled her back so the patrons of the cafe couldn't see that he was breaking the law.
"Take those out of your pocket."
He scoffed.
"These are valuable spices."
"You would steal?"
"Nay, I'm no thief. But this is cinnamon and cocoa. 'Tis not so easy to come by. We're nearly out, and Sylvan loves it."
"But it's not yours,"
she said, trying to be patient.
"I am the McKelter,"
he said, clearly trying to be patient.
"Everything is mine."
"Put them back."
His grin was pure male challenge.
"You put them back."
"I am not rooting around in your pockets."
"Then they stay where they are."
"You are so stubborn."
"I am. I, woman who insists everything be her way."
He fisted his hands at his waist and shifted his voice into a higher octave, imitating her.
"You must wear hard-weight shoes. You must remove your weapons. You must travel in a car. You must not kiss me, even though I wrap my legs around you when you do."
Shrugging irritably, he reverted to his deep brogue.
"Must, must, must. I weary of that word."
Cheeks flaming over the jibe about her unruly legs, Gwen thrust her hand in his pocket and closed her fingers around the small glass bottles.
"Sylvan will be most unhappy,"
he said, stepping closer with a wolfish smile.
"Sylvan died 5 centuries ago, according to you."
The moment she said the words, she regretted them. A flash of pain crossed his face, and she could have kicked herself for being so callous. If he was ill, he might genuinely believe everything he was telling her. And if so, the death of his father, real or imagined, would hurt him.
"I'm sorry,"
she said quickly. She sprinkled cinnamon on their frothy cappuccinos. Then, to atone for her unkind words, she slipped the bottle back in his pocket, trying to ignore the duly disturbing facts that she was aiding and abetting a criminal, and that she was so close to his sock, which rhymed nicely with cock, and oh, it had been an eyeful in those jeans. Angrily, he plunged his hand into his pocket, pulled both bottles out, and plunked them on the little condiment stand. Without a word, he turned his back to her and stalked out the door. Gwen hastened after him, and as she passed a table where a distinguished-looking man sat with his wife and son, she heard the boy say,
"Can you believe they were going to steal the cinnamon and chocolate? They didn't look poor. Did you see his sword? Wow, it was better than the Highlanders!"
Embarrassed, Gwen tucked the bag of pastries beneath her arm, juggled both cups of coffee, and struggled with the door.
"Drustin! Wait, Drustin, I'm sorry!"
she called to his broad, stubborn back. He stopped mid-step, and when he turned around, he was smiling. Was that how brief the duration of his anger? She caught her breath and held it. He was simply the most beautiful man she'd ever seen, and when he smiled...
"You like me."
"I do not," she lied. "But I didn't mean to hurt your feelings."
He was undaunted.
You like me, lass, I can tell. You call me by my given name, and you are frowning with dewy eyes. I forgive you for being so cruel and thoughtless."
She changed the subject hastily and addressed something that had been bothering her since they'd left Barrett's and that snooty Miriam.
"Drustin, what does Niaf mean?"
He looked startled, then laughed.
"Who dared call you a wee Niaf?"
"That snotty woman in Barrett's, and quit laughing at me."
"Oh, lass."
More laughter.
"Well, what does it mean?"
"Do you wish the whole gist of it, or a simple one-word summary? Not that I can think of one at the moment," he added. "It's a uniquely Scots word."
"The whole gist of it," she snapped.
Eyes sparkling, a brow mischievously arched, he said,
"As you wish. It means one who is irritating, much like a midge. One whose capacity to annoy and inspire contempt exceeds her diminutive size, but not the cockiness that accompanies it.
Gwyn was seething by the time he finished. She turned around and stomped back toward Barrett's to tell perfectly plucked Miriam precisely what she thought of her.
"Hold, lass,"
he said, catching up with her and closing his hand about her upper arm.
"'Tis plain to see she was merely jealous of you,"
he told her soothingly.
"For having a fine, braw man such as me at your side, especially after she beheld me in those blue trews."
Gwyn plunked her fists at her waist.
"Oh, could you be any more pleased with yourself?"
"You're no niaf, lass," he said, gently tucking a strand of hair behind her ear. "She was like as not far more envious of the look on my face when I gaze upon you."
Well, her sails deflated. Gwyn felt suddenly much more charitable toward Miriam, and it must have shown on her face, because he smiled arrogantly.
"Now you like me even more."
"I do not,"
she said, stiffly pulling her arm from his grasp.
"Let's go get that rental car and get out of here."
God forgive her, she was beginning to more than like him. She was feeling territorial, protective, and downright lusty.
September 20th, 7:32 p.m. Chapter 8.
One flat tire, in the company of a man who had no idea how to change one, and no jack, a pit stop for his weapons, 3 rest stops, 4 coffees, and a very late lunch later, they arrived at the outskirts of Alboreth, just as dusk was falling. Gwyn sneaked a glance at him and wondered if the color would ever return to his face. She'd pushed the shuddering car up to 70, but quickly relented when he'd gripped the sides of his seat so tightly that if she'd tapped him with a fingernail, he might have shattered. It was a good thing she'd slowed down, because the tire had gone flat 2 miles outside of Fairhaven, and they'd had to walk back and get a person from the rental agency to arrange for a serviceman to get the tire changed. She tried to rent a different vehicle, but as all were under contract, it was this one or none until tomorrow evening. Tire changed, they'd resumed their drive, and eventually he'd relaxed enough to turn his attention to the coffee and pastries. After complaining because she'd gotten no kippers and tatties, he consumed the coffee and chocolate with gusto. The pleasure he'd exhibited over such mundane items had further irritated her. God help her, but she was nearly beginning to believe him. They hadn't talked much on the drive, although not for her lack of trying. He simply hadn't seemed able to relax enough to speak. Now, as the lights of Alboreth came into view, nestled in a lush valley, his complexion was ghastly in the gloaming.
"Would you like to stop in the village?"
"Nay,"
he replied tersely. He pried his fingers from the edge of the seat and pointed to a road north of the village.
"You must guide this metal beast to the crest of that, Ben."
Gwyn eyed the mountain to which he'd pointed. There were 277 mountains in Scotland, so said her brochure, that exceeded 3,000 feet, and he was pointing to one of them. Sighing, she circled the village, downshifting when she reached the mountain. She'd been hoping to coax him to have dinner and secure a reprieve before confronting the extent of his delusions.
"Tell me about your home,"
she urged. The day had been a trial for both of them, and she felt a sudden spear of concern. She was about to take him home, and what if there wasn't one there? What if the next few hours critically stressed his already damaged mind? She was supposed to stay with him until tomorrow night to see his proof, although, technically, she'd fulfilled her end of the bargain. She'd gotten him safely to Ban Drocade. She had a feeling technically didn't mean much to a man of his ilk.
"Dunna think you'll be leaving me now,"
he said, placing his hand over hers on the gear stick. Gwyn glanced sharply at him.
"What are you, a mind reader?"
He half smiled.
"Nay, I'm merely reminding you that your bargain with me was that you would stay to see my proof. I will not let you fail me now."
"What are you going to do, chain me again?"
she said dryly. When he didn't answer, she took another look at him. God above, but the man looked dangerous. His silver metal eyes were cool and frighteningly calm, and yes, he would chain her again. For a split second, in the eerie, bruised half-light of gloaming, he looked as if he had truly stepped forward 5 centuries, a barbaric warrior intent on his quest, and nothing or no one would get in his way.
"I have no intention of reneging," she said stiffly.
"I assume reneging means to act with dishonor," he said flatly. "Good, for I would not permit it."
They drove in silence for a time.
"Do you enjoy a bard's rhymes, Gwyn?"
She glanced sharply at him.
"I have been accused of enjoying poetry from time to time."
"Romantic poetry. The kind never read at Shea Cassidy when I was a child," she thought.
"Would you grant me a boon?"
"Ah, sure, why not?"
she said with a sigh a martyr would envy.
"I've already done 50 gazillion. What could one more possibly hurt?"
He gave her a faint smile, then spoke quietly and clearly.
"Whither thou goest, there goest I. 2 flames sparked from but 1 ember. Both forward and backward doth time fly. Whither thou art, remember."
She shrugged, confused. It had started out rather romantic, but hadn't ended that way.
"What does it mean?"
"Have you a good memory, Gwyn Cassidy?"
he evaded.
"Of course I do." Oh God, he was losing it, she thought.
"Re-say it to me."
She looked at him. His face was pale, his hands fisted in his lap. His expression was deadly serious. For no other reason than to appease him, she made him repeat it, then repeated it without error.
"Is there a point to this?"
she asked when she'd said it 3 times perfectly. It was permanently etched in her mind.
"It's made me happy. Thank you."
"That seems to have become my purpose in life," she said dryly. "Is this another one of those things that will become clear to me in time?"
"If all goes well, nay," he replied, and something in his voice made a shiver kiss her spine. "Pray, you need never understand."
She changed the subject uneasily, and for the duration of the ride they spoke of innocuous things while her tension mounted. He described his castle lovingly, first the grounds, then the interior and some of the recent renovations. She spoke of her mindless job, but said little else of significance. Gwyn had been conditioned not to over-disclose. The more a man knew about her, the less he ended up liking her, and for reasons she couldn't explain to herself, she wanted Druston McKelter to like her. It seemed they were both suddenly eager to fill the silence, or it would swallow them alive. By the time they reached the top of the mountain, Gwyn's hands were trembling on the steering wheel, but when he lifted a hand to rake his hair from his face, she saw that his were, too. She didn't miss the significance of the fact. He was not playing with her. He genuinely hoped to find his castle at the top of this mountain. Firmly grounded in his delusion, he also feared that it might no longer stand. Sneaking cautious peeks at him, she grudgingly conceded that he was not suffering amnesia or playing some strange game. He believed he was what he claimed he was. The realization was far from reassuring. A physical injury would heal. A mental aberration was much more difficult to cure. Steeling herself, she backed off the gas, reluctant to complete the journey. She wished she'd hiked it with him, so she wouldn't have to face this moment now. If she'd done it his way, she could have postponed it for another 24 hours.
"Turn north."
"But there's no road there."
"I see that," he said grimly. "And considering the ones upon which we've traveled thus far, one would think there should be. A fact that concerns me."
She turned left, and the headlights of the car limned a grassy knoll.
"Up the hill,"
he urged softly. Drawing a deep breath, Gwyn obeyed. When he snapped at her to stop, she didn't need the command, for she'd monkeyed the clutch and was about to stall anyway. The tips of the towering stones of Bandrocade loomed over the crest of the hill, black against a misty purple sky.
I don't see a castle, McKelter,
she said hesitantly.
'Tis beyond the fell. The Mon conceals it because it sits farther back, past the stones. Come, I will show you.
He fumbled with the door latch, then burst from the car. Fell and Mon must mean hill or crest, she decided as she killed the lights and joined him. The tremor in her hands had spread to the rest of her body, and she was suddenly chilled.
Wait, let me grab my sweatshirt, she said.
He waited impatiently, his gaze fixed upon the tops of the stones, and she knew he was desperate to get up over the crest to see if his castle still stood. No more eager than she was to delay it.
Do you want a bite to eat before we go?
She said brightly, reaching for the salmon patties and celery they'd boxed up at the last stop. He smiled faintly.
Come, Gwen. Now.
With a resigned shrug, she slammed the car door shut and trudged to his side. When he took her hand in his, she didn't even try to pull away, but inched closer, as much for her support as his. They hiked the remainder of the incline in silence, unbroken but for the chirping of crickets and the melodic hum of tree frogs. At the top, she drew in a sharp breath. Against the backdrop of pink and purple-streaked sky, a gentle breeze ruffled the grass within the circle of stones. She counted 13 of them, ranged about a great slab in the center. The megaliths reared up, black against the brilliant horizon. There was nothing beyond the stones. Oh, a few pines, and granted there were several gentle slopes that might block one's vision, but nothing that a castle could crouch mischievously behind. They moved forward in silence, cutting through the circle of stones, much more slowly now, for ahead of them, past stumps of what had once been lofty and ancient oaks, was the clear foundation of a castle that no longer stood. She refused to look at him. She would not look at him. When they reached the perimeter of the outer wall, he sank to his knees. Gwyn eyed the tall grass in the center of the ruin, the chunks of stone and mortar in crumbling piles, the night sky beyond the silent castle grave. Anything but him, dreading what she would see. Anguish? Horror? Realization that he truly was mentally unbalanced, flickering in those beautiful silver eyes that seemed so misleadingly clear?
Oh, Christ! They're all dead, he whispered.
Who destroyed my people? Why?
He drew a shuddering breath.
Gwyn!
The word was strangled.
Tristan,
she said softly.
I bid you return to your wagon for a time.
Gwyn hesitated, torn. Half of her wanted nothing more than to tuck tail and run. The other half felt that he needed her desperately here and now.
I'm not leaving now.
Go!
He sounded so anguished that Gwyn flinched and looked at him. His eyes were dark and unreadable, but for a shimmer of moisture.
Tristan,
I beg of you, leave me now, he whispered. Leave me to mourn my clan alone.
The faintness of his voice deceived her.
I promised not to just abandon.
Now!
He thundered. When she still didn't move, his eyes blazed.
You will obey me!
Gwyn noticed three things in the time it took him to utter the command. First, although she knew it was impossible, his silvery eyes seemed to blaze from deep within like something she'd once seen in a sci-fi movie. Second, his voice was different, sounded like a dozen voices layered upon one another, obliterating any conscious choice. And third, she suspected if he'd ordered her to walk off a cliff in such a voice, she might. Her legs broke into an instinctive sprint even as her brain was processing those startling observations. But a few paces inside the stones, the eerie compulsion receded, and she stopped and glanced back. He'd entered the ruin and climbed the highest pile of collapsed stone, a black silhouette on his knees, back arched, chest canted skyward, he shook his fist at the indigo sky. When he tossed his head back and roared, the blood curdled in her veins. Was this the same man who'd kissed her in the fitting room? The one who'd gotten her hotter than a volcano and as prone to imminent explosion, and made her think there might be an equation for passion her parents had never taught her? No. This was the man who wore 50 weapons on his body. This was the man who carried a double-bladed axe and a sword. This was the man to whom she'd begun losing a little piece of an organ that she'd been raised to believe was merely an efficient pump. The realization startled her. Madman or no, frightening or not, he made her feel things she'd never felt before.
McKelter, she thought, what on earth am I going to do with you?
Druston wept. The worst was true. He lay on his back in the great hall, one knee bent, arms spread wide, his fingers laced in the tall grass, and thought of Sylvan.
You have only one purpose, son, as do I. Protect the Keltar line and the knowledge we guard.
He'd failed. In a moment of carelessness, he'd been taken unaware, enchanted, stolen from his time and buried for centuries. His disappearance had triggered the destruction of his castle and clan. Now, Sylvan was dead. The Keltar line extinguished, and Hugh knew where the tablets and volumes were. The possibility of such knowledge falling into the wrong hands dragged him down into a deep black place beyond fear. He knew that a greedy man could reshape, control, or destroy the entire world with such knowledge. Protect the line. Protect the lore. It was imperative that he successfully return to his time. Although he had not changed so much as one hair, 500 years had passed, and nothing remained to speak of his existence or the life of his father and his father's father before him. Millennia of training and discipline, all gone in the blink of an eye. Tomorrow night, he would enter the stones and perform the ritual. Tomorrow night, he would not exit the stones. One way or another, he would no longer be in the here and now. And God willing, tomorrow her century would matter no more, for with luck, by Maybon High he would have undone all the wrong that had been done. Still, for the time he had remaining in the 21st century, his people were as dead as his castle was destroyed, not more than ancient dream dust blowing ignobly across Scotland. Roughly dragging the back of his hand across his cheeks, he pushed himself to his feet and spent the next hour wandering the ruin, looking for graves. He uncovered not one new marker in the chapel yard. Where had his clan gone? If they died, where had they been buried? Where was Sylvan's marker? Sylvan had made it painstakingly clear that he wished to be interred beneath the rowan behind the chapel. Yet no stone marker proclaimed his name. Dagus McKelter, beloved brother and son. He swept shaking fingers over the stone that marked his brother's grave. Unable to comprehend the passage of 5 centuries, Druston suffered the fever-hot grief of having buried Dagus only a fortnight past. His brother's death had made him crazed. They'd been close as two people could be. When he'd lost his brother, he'd argued endless hours with his father.
What good is it to have the knowledge of the stones if I cannot go back and undo Dagus's death?
He'd shouted at Sylvan.
You must never travel to a point within your own life!
Sylvan had snapped, weary and red-eyed from weeping.
Why can I not return to a time within my own past? If you are too close in proximity to your past self, one of you, either your past or present self, won't survive. We have no way of foretelling which one lives. There have been times when neither survived. It seems to stress the natural order of things, and nature struggles to correct itself. Then I'll choose a time in the past when I was across the border in England.
Druston snarled, refusing to accept that Dagus was irrevocably gone.
No one knows how far away is far enough, son. Besides, you are forgetting that we may never use the stones for personal reasons. They are to be used only for the greater good of the world, or in extreme circumstances to ensure the succession of the McKelter. One of us must always live. But these are not extreme circumstances, and you know what would happen if you abused the power.
Aye, he knew. Legend handed down over the centuries claimed a Keltar who used the stones for personal reasons would become a dark druid the moment he passed through. Lost to honor and compassion, he would relinquish his very soul to the blackest forces of evil, become a creature of irreverent destruction.
"The hell with the legend!"
he'd thundered defiantly. But even in his grief, he'd known better. Whether or not the legend was true, he would not be the first McKelter to trespass on such sacred territory. Nay, he would accept, as all his ancestors had accepted, and honor his oaths. He had not been given unfathomable power to abuse it, or use it for personal gain. He couldn't justify using the stones to mend his own heart. If he saved Dagus and became a dark druid, what then would he do when Sylvan grew ever older? Cheat fate again? A man could go crazy with so much power and no limits. Once he crossed such a line, there would be no turning back. He would indeed become a master of the black arts. And so, he'd bid farewell to Dagus and resworn his oath to his father.
"I will never use the stones for personal reasons, only to serve and protect, and to preserve our line should it be threatened with extinction."
As it was now. Drustin ran a hand through his hair, exhaling. Dagus was dead. Sylvan was dead. He was the only remaining Keltar, and his duty was clear. For 500 years the world had been unprotected by a Keltar druid. He had to return and do whatever was necessary to restore a concurrent succession of the Keltar, at any cost.
"And what about the price the woman will pay?" his conscience chided. "I have no choice," he muttered darkly. He plunged his hands into his hair and massaged his temples with the heels of his palms.
He knew by rote the formulas for the 13 stones, but he did not know the critical 3, the ones that would specify the year, the month, the day. It was imperative that he return to the 16th century shortly after his abduction. Whoever had lured him beyond the castle walls would not be able to penetrate the fortress of Castle Keltar, even with a full army, for at least several days. The castle was too well fortified to be taken easily. So long as he returned a day, or even 2, after his abduction, he should still have time to save his clan, castle, and all the information within its walls. He would defeat his enemy, marry and have 12 children. With Dagus dead, he finally understood the urgency Sylvan had tried to impart to his sons to rebuild the Keltar line.
"Drustin, you must learn to conceal your arts from women and take a wife, any wife. I was blessed with your mother. 'Twas a miraculous and uncommon thing, though I wish the same for you. 'Tis too dangerous to have so few Keltar."
Aye, he'd learned that the hard way. He rubbed his eyes and exhaled. He had a minuscule target at which to aim, and he'd never studied the symbols he now needed. He'd been forbidden to travel within his lifetime, so there had been no reason for him to commit to memory the symbols spanning his generation. Yet, in a dark moment of weakness and longing, he'd looked up the ones that would have taken him back to the morning of Dagus's death, and from those forbidden symbols he could attempt to derive the shapes and lines of the 3 he needed now. Still, it would be a guess, an incredibly risky guess, with dire consequences if he didn't get them right. Which brought him back to the tablets. If Sylvan had been able to hide them somewhere on the grounds before he'd suffered whatever fate had befallen him, Drustin wouldn't have to guess. He could calculate the symbols he needed from the information on the tablets with no fear of error. He felt fairly certain that if he returned himself to the day after his abduction, the leagues between his future self and his enchanted body, coupled with the thick stone walls of the cave, would be enough distance between them. He had no choice but to believe that. Dresden glanced around the ruins. While he'd brooded, full night had fallen and it was too dark to conduct a thorough search, which left him tomorrow to hunt for the tablets and try to recall the symbols. And if the tablets weren't there? Well, then, that was why there was wee, sweet, unsuspecting Gwyn. Wee, sweet, unsuspecting Gwyn perched on the hood of the car, munching celery sticks and salmon patties and absorbing the remaining warmth of the engine. She glanced at her watch. Nearly 2 hours had passed since she'd left Dresden at the ruin. She could leave now. Just hop in the car, slam it into reverse, and squeal off to the village below. Leave the madman alone to sort out his own problems. Then why didn't she? Pondering Newton's law of universal gravitation, she considered the possibility that since Dresden's mass was so much greater than hers, she was doomed to be attracted to him so long as he was in her near vicinity, as much a victim of gravity as the Earth orbiting the sun. Lost in thought, she hummed absently as she huddled on the hood, shivering as the indigo sky deepened to black cashmere, arguing with herself and reaching no firm conclusions. She couldn't shake the feeling that she was overlooking one or more critical facts that might help her figure out what had happened to him. She'd never given any credence to gut instinct. She'd believed the gut controlled hunger and waste, nothing Gnostic. But in the past 36 hours, something in her gut had found a voice. It was arguing with her mind, and she was baffled by the discord. She had remained in the stones and watched him for some time before she'd sought the warmth of the hood of the car. She'd studied him with the remote candor of a scientist observing a test subject in an experiment, but her study of him had only revealed more contradictions rather than resolving any. His body was powerfully developed, and a man didn't get a body like that without extraordinary discipline, effort, and a mind capable of sustained focus. Wherever he had been before she'd found him in the cave, he'd lived an active, balanced life. He'd either worked hard or played hard, and she decided it was more work than play, because his hands were calloused, and no stuffy jock-type aristocrat had calluses on fingers and palms. His silky black hair was too long to be considered apropos on a 21st-century lord and gentleman, but it was glossy and well-cut. His teeth were even and white, more evidence of care for his body. People who devoted attention to their physical health were usually healthy in mind as well. He walked with a gait that bespoke confidence, strength, and the ability to make hard decisions. He was reasonably intelligent and well-spoken, his strange inflection and vocabulary aside. He hadn't known the way out of the cave, and when they had emerged, Gwyn hadn't missed the significance of the collapsed tunnel and the overgrowth of foliage.
"Oh, Christ, they're all dead," he'd whispered.
She shivered. The engine had cooled, the remnants of heat gone. Occam's razor promulgated that the simplest explanation that fit the majority of the facts was most likely true. The simplest explanation here was, he was telling the truth. He'd somehow been put into a deep sleep 500 years ago against his will, perhaps via some lost science, and she'd awakened him by falling on him. "Impossible," her mind exclaimed. Tired of trying to coax the jury to deliver a consensus, she reluctantly accepted the hung verdict and admitted that she couldn't leave him. What if the impossible was possible? What if tomorrow he offered her some concrete proof that he had been frozen in time for nearly 500 years? Perhaps he planned to show her how it had been done, some advanced cryogenics that had been lost over time. She wasn't vacating the premises if there was even a remote possibility of finding out such a thing.
"Oh, admit it, Gwyn. Despite having dropped out on the profession that has been eternally crammed down your throat, despite refusing to continue your research, you're still fascinated by science, and you'd love to know how a man could somehow sleep for 5 centuries and wake up healthy and whole. You'd never publish it, but you'd still love to know."
But it was more than just scientific curiosity, and she suspected it had something to do with his sock and her eggs and a desire she couldn't attribute solely to the mandate programmed into her genes that clamored for survival of her race. No other man had ever incited such a response in her. Science couldn't explain the tenderness she'd felt at the sight of tears in his eyes, nor the desire she'd had to cradle his head against her chest, not to have her cherry once and truly plucked, but for his comfort. Oh, her heart was engaged, and it both alarmed and elated her. Tucking her bangs behind an ear, she slid off the hood and started up the hill. He'd had enough time alone. It was time to talk.
Justin!
Gwyn's voice cut like a light through the darkness around him. He met her gaze levelly. The poor wee lass looked terrified, yet bristled with resolve. She looked directly into his eyes then, and if she felt fear, she rose above it. He admired that about her, that despite her misgivings she forged on with the valor of a knight entering battle. When he'd chased her off, he worried that she might simply jump in her metal beast and drive away. The relief he'd felt when he glimpsed her heading toward him through the stones had been intense. Whatever she'd decided to think of him, she'd resolved to stick by his side. He could see it in her eyes.
Justin!
Hesitant, yet firm.
Aye, lass.
Are you feeling better now?
She asked warily.
I have made a tentative peace with my feelings,
he said dryly.
Fear not. I do not plan to leap up and avenge the loss of my people.
Yet, he added to himself. She gave him a brisk nod.
Good.
He could tell that she didn't wish to discuss it, and rather than accuse him of being deluded when he was clearly distraught, she was going to scuttle around it in some circuitous manner. He narrowed his eyes, wondering what she was up to.
Justin, I memorized your poem. Now it's your turn to grant me a favor.
As you wish, Gwyn. Only tell me what you want of me.
A few simple questions.
I will answer them to the best of my ability, he replied.
How much dirt is in a hole a foot wide, 9 inches long, and 3.5 feet deep?
That is your question,
he asked, baffled, of all things she might have asked.
One of them,
she said hastily. He smiled faintly. Her question was one of his favorite puzzles. His priest, Nevin, had agonized for half an hour trying to calculate exactly how much dirt would be in such a space before seeing the obvious.
There is no dirt in a hole, he replied easily.
Oh, well, that was a trick puzzle and doesn't tell me much. You may have heard it before. How about this one? A boat lies at anchor with a rope ladder hanging over the side. The rungs in the rope ladder are 9 inches apart. The tide rises at a rate of 6 inches per hour and then falls at the same rate. If one rung of the ladder is just touching the water when the tide begins to rise, how many rungs will be covered after 8 hours?
Drustin ran through a swift series of calculations, then laughed softly, at a time when he thought he might not laugh again. He suddenly understood why she had chosen such questions, and his regard for her increased. When an apprentice petitioned a druid to be accepted and trained, he was put through a similar series of problems designed to reveal how the lad's mind worked and what he was capable of.
None, lass. The rope ladder rises with the boat upon the water. Do my powers of reason convince you that I am not mad?
She regarded him strangely.
Your reasoning abilities seem untouched by your peculiar illness. So, what is 4,732.25 multiplied by 7,837.5?
37,089,009.375.
My God!
She said, looking simultaneously awed and revolted.
You poor thing. I asked the first question mostly to see if you were thinking clearly, the second to see if the first had been a fluke. But you did that math in your head in 5 seconds. Even I can't do it that fast.
He shrugged.
I have always had an affinity for numbers. Did your questions prove anything to you?
They had proved something to him. Gwyn Cassidy was the most intelligent lass he'd ever met. Young, seemingly fertile, an extraordinary mating heat between them, and smart. His certainty that fate had brought her to him for a reason increased tenfold. Mayhap, he thought, she might not fear him after tomorrow eve. Mayhap there was such a love for him as his father had known.
Well, if you're a candidate for Bedlam, you're the smartest madman I've ever met, and your delusions seem confined to one issue.
She blew out a breath.
Ah, so, what now?
Come, lass.
He held his arms out to her. She eyed him warily.
Ah, lassie, give me something to hold in my arms that's real and sweet. I will not harm you.
She trudged to his side and sank down in the grass beside him. She kept her face averted for several moments, gazing up at the stars. Then her shoulders slumped and she looked at him.
Oh, bother,
she said, and stunned him by reaching out to cradle his head in her arms, pulling him to her breast. He slid his hands around her waist and pulled her onto his lap.
Lovely Gwyn, 'tis thinking you once again I am. You are a gift from the angels.
I wouldn't be so sure about that,
she muttered against his hair. She seemed awkward holding him, as if she hadn't had much practice. Her body was tense, and he sensed if he moved suddenly that she would jerk away. So he breathed slowly and kept still, allowing her time to grow accustomed to the intimacy.
I guess this means you won't be able to prove anything to me tomorrow, huh?
As promised. On the morrow I will prove to you my story is true. This changes nothing, or little. Will you stay of your own volition? Mayhap help me explore the grounds tomorrow?
Hesitantly, she slipped her wee hands into his hair, and he half sighed, half groaned with pleasure when her nails lightly grazed his scalp.
I Drosten McKelter,
she said with as good a lilt as any Scots lass.
I'll be staying wi' ye till the morrow.
He laughed aloud and pulled her closer. He craved her touch, wanted desperately to make love to her, but sensed that if he pressed her now, he would lose the comfort of her embrace.
That was fine, lass. You're no bampot, and I'm thinking we may make a wee deuce Highland lass out of ye yet.
Gwyn slept that night curled in the arms of a Highlander, in a field of siller shakels and gowan, beneath a silvery spoon of a moon, peaceful as a lamb. And if Drosten was feeling wolfish, he bid himself be content merely to hold her. September 21st, 10:23 p.m. Chapter 9. They searched all day, but didn't find the tablets. When the sky darkened to indigo, pierced by glittering stars, Drosten gave up and constructed a bonfire within the circle of stones so we would have light by which to perform the ritual. If the worst occurred tonight, he wanted her to know as much about what had happened to him as possible, and her backpack would be an added boon. While digging in the ruins, he'd told her everything that had transpired just prior to his abduction. One disbelieving brow arched, she'd nevertheless listened as he explained how he'd received a note bearing an urgent summons to come to the clearing behind the little lock. If ye wish to ken the name of the Campbell who murdered your brother. His grief, fever hot, he donned his weapons and rushed off without summoning his guard. The thirst to avenge his brother's death had overridden all intelligent thought. He told her how he'd grown light-headed and weary while racing toward the lock, and that he now believed he'd somehow been drugged. He told her how he'd collapsed just outside the forest on the banks of the lock, how his limbs had locked, his eyes had closed as if weighted by heavy gold coins. He told her he'd felt his armor and weapons being removed, then symbols being painted on his chest, then felt nothing more until she'd wakened him. Then he told her of his family, of his brilliant and bristly father, of their beloved housekeeper and substitute mother, Nell. He told her of his young priest, whose nagging, fortune-telling mother was wont to chase him ceaselessly about the estate, trying to get a look at his palm. He forgot his sorrow for a time, and regaled her with tales of his childhood with Dagus. When he spoke of his family, her skeptical gaze had softened a bit, and she'd listened with marked fascination, laughing over the antics of Drosten and his brother, smiling gently over the ongoing sparring between Sylvan and Nell, He deduced from her wistful expression that, even when her family had been alive, there'd not been much laughter and loving in her life.
"Have you no brothers and sisters, lass?"
he'd asked. She'd shaken her head.
"My mother had fertility problems and had me late in life. After she had me, the doctors said she couldn't have any more."
"Why have you not wed and had bairn of your own?"
She shifted and averted her gaze.
"I never found the right man."
Nay, she'd not had much pleasure in her life, and he'd liked the chance to change that. He'd like to make her eyes sparkle with happiness. He wanted Gwyn Cassidy. He wanted to be her right man. The mere scent of her as she walked by brought every inch of him to attention. He wanted her to become so familiar with his body and the pleasure he could give her with it that a simple glance would make her limp with desire. He wanted to pass a fortnight, uninterrupted, in his bedchamber, exploring her hidden passion, unleashing the eroticism that simmered just beneath her surface. But it might never come to pass, because once he performed the ritual and she discovered what he was, and what he'd done to her, she would have every reason to despise him. Still, he had no other choice. Casting a worried glance at the arc of the moon against the black sky, he inhaled deeply, greedily of the sweet Highland night air. The time was nearly upon them.
"Let it rest, Gwyn," he called.
He was moved that she refused to give up. Mad though she might think him, she was still digging about in the ruins.
"Come join me in the stones," he beckoned.
He wanted to spend what might be his last hour with her, close to the fire, holding her in his arms. His druthers were to strip off her clothes and bury himself inside her, brand himself into her memory with what time he had left. But that seemed as likely as the tablets suddenly manifesting themselves in his hands.
"But we haven't found the tablets!"
She turned toward him, smudging dirt on her cheek when she pushed back her hair.
"'Tis too late now, lass. The time is nearly upon us, and that tube of light,"
he gestured at her flashlight,
"won't help us see what isn't there to be found. 'Twas a vain and foolish hope that they might have survived intact on the estate. If we haven't found them yet, the next hour will accomplish naught. Come, spend it with me."
He held out his arms. She'd slept within them last night, and he'd awakened to the lovely sight of her face, trusting and innocent in repose. He'd kissed her full, lush lips, and when she'd awakened, sleep-flushed, with crease marks on her cheek from being pressed to his wrinkled T-shirt, he'd felt a rush of tenderness he'd not felt for a woman before. Lust, ever at a boil within him when she was near, had simmered into a more intense, complexly layered feeling, and he'd recognized that given time he could fall deeply in love with her, not merely ache to keep her in bed without respite, but develop a real and lasting emotion, equal parts passion, respect, and appreciation, the kind that bound a man and a woman together for life. She was everything he wanted in a woman. Gwyn trudged into the circle, clearly reluctant to give up when there was even one stone unturned, another trait he admired in her.
"Why won't you tell me what you plan to do?"
All day she'd tried to coax it out of him, but he'd refused to tell her anything more than that they were looking for 7 stone tablets inscribed with symbols.
"I said I'd give you proof, and I will."
A stunning, irrevocable amount of proof. The hours had dragged on as they searched, tossing rocks and rubble, and his hope had steadily faded with each broken chip of pottery, each time-worn memento of his dead clan. At one point, futility had nearly overwhelmed him, and he'd sent her down to the village with a list of items to pick up so he would have time to think, undistracted. During her absence, he'd meditated upon the symbols, working through complex calculations and derived his best guess at the last 3, the guess that would be put to the test in less than 1 hour. He was aiming for 2 weeks after his brother's death, plus 1 day. He was almost certain they were correct, and believed there was only a minute chance the worst would happen. And if the worst happened, he had prepared her well, and need only remind her what to say and do to restore complete, merged memory to the past version of himself. 'Twas why he'd bid her memorize the spell. She'd picked up several jugs of water, along with flashlights, coffee, and food, and now sat beside him near the fire, cross-legged, cleaning her hands with dampened towels, emitting little sighs of pleasure as she scrubbed at her face with tiny pads from her pack. While she freshened up, he broke open the stones he'd collected during their hike. Inside each was a core of brilliant dust, which he scraped carefully into a tin and blended with water to form a thick paste. "Paint rocks," she said, intrigued enough to pause in her ablutions. She'd never seen one, but knew the ancients had used them to paint with. They were small and craggy, and deep in the center a dust formed over time that made brilliant colors when mixed with water.
"Aye, 'tis what we call them as well," he said, rising to his feet.
Gwyn watched as he moved to one of the megaliths and, after a moment's hesitation, began etching a complex design of formulas and symbols. She narrowed her eyes, studying it. Parts of it seemed somehow familiar yet alien, a perverted mathematical equation that danced just out of her reach, and there was little that did that to her. A beat of nervous apprehension thudded in her chest, and she watched intently as he moved to the next stone, then the third and the fourth. On each of the stones he etched a different series of numbers and symbols upon their inner faces, pausing occasionally to glance up at the stars. The autumnal equinox, she reflected, was the time when the sun crossed the plains of the Earth's equator, making night and day of approximately equal length all over the Earth. Researchers had long argued over the precise use of the standing stones. Was she about to find out their real purpose? She eyed the megaliths and pondered what she knew about archaeoastronomy. When he finished sketching upon the 13th and final stone, her breath caught in her throat. Although she recognized only parts of it, he'd clearly stroked the symbol for infinity beneath it, the lemniscate, the Mobius strip, Apeiron. What knowledge did he have of it? She scanned the 13 stones and felt a peculiar itchy sensation in her mind, as if an epiphany was trying to burrow into her overcrowded brain. Watching him, she was struck by a stunning possibility. Was it possible that he was smarter than she was? Was that his madness? Gorgeous and smart? Be still, my beating heart. As he turned away from the last stone, she shivered. Physically, he was irresistible. He was wearing his original costume of plaid and armor again, having shed such trews that do not let a man hang properly and an inar that cannot conceal an oxter knife, as soon as he'd awakened that morning. Hang properly indeed, she thought, gaze skipping over his kilt, mouth going dry as she imagined what was hanging beneath it. Was he in that seemingly permanent state of semi-arousal? She'd like to kiss him until there was nothing semi about it. With effort, she dragged her gaze to his face. His sleek hair was a wild fall about his shoulders. He was the most intense, exciting, and erotic man she'd ever met. When she was around Drustan McKelter, inexplicable things happened to her. When she looked at him, his powerful body, his chiseled jaw, the flashing eyes and sensual mouth, she heard Pan's distant pipes and suffered an irresistible compulsion to tithe to Dionysus, the ancient god of wine and orgy. The tune was seductive, urging her to cast aside restraint, don her crimson kitten thong, and dance barefoot for a dark, forbidding man who claimed he was a 16th-century laird. He glanced back at her, and their gazes collided. She felt like a time bomb ready to explode, ticking, ticking. Her face must have betrayed her feelings, because he inhaled sharply. His nostrils flared, his eyes narrowed, and he went quiet, with the perfect stillness of a mountain lion before hurling itself at its prey. She swallowed.
"What are you doing with those stones?"
she forced herself to ask, flustered by the intensity of what she was feeling.
"Don't you think it's time you tell me?"
"I have told you all I can."
His eyes were cool slate, the crystalline light that usually danced within them subdued.
"You don't trust me. After all I've done to help, you still don't trust me."
She didn't try to conceal that it hurt her feelings.
"Och, lass, do not be thinking such. "'Tis merely that some things are forbidden.'
"'Not really,' he amended silently. "'But he simply couldn't risk revealing his plans yet, "'lest she abandon him.'
"'Bullshit!'
she said, impatient with his evasions.
"'If you trust me, nothing is forbidden.'
"'I do trust you, wee lass. "'I am trusting you far more than you know. "'With my life, possibly even with my clan's very existence,' he thought.
"'How am I supposed to believe in you when you won't confide in me?'
"'Ever the doubter, are you not, Gwen?'
he chided. "'Kiss me, before I sketch the final symbols, for bonny fortune,' he urged. Shards of crystal glittered in his eyes, reminding her that although sometimes he banked his passionate nature, it was always simmering just beneath the surface. Gwen started to speak, but he laid a finger to her lips.
"'Please, lass, just kiss me. No more words. There have been enough of them between us.'
He paused before adding quietly,
"'If you have aught to say to me, let your heart speak now.'
She took a deep breath. There was no question what her heart was saying. Earlier that afternoon, when she'd gone down to the village, she dug her crimson thong out of her pack, and after washing up, had put it on. Then she'd peeled off her nicotine patch, preferring outright withdrawal to having to explain its presence on her body. She was not going to make love for the first time with a patch on. Besides, once she'd made the decision, a remarkable calm had settled over her. She knew what she was going to do. Truth be told, she'd probably known the moment he'd opened his eyes that she was going to give him her virginity. The past 2 days had been nothing more than her way of growing accustomed to the thought, so she would be less apprehensive when she finally did it. She wasn't simply attracted to him. She was drawn to him on every level, mentally, emotionally, and physically. She wanted him in a way that had no rhyme or reason. She felt things when he spoke to her and touched her that originated from a unique place inside her. It no longer mattered to her that he might be mentally unbalanced. During the passage of the day, digging beside him in the ruins of the castle while he talked of the various members of his clan, she'd realized that she was going to stick by him until he worked out whatever reality problem he was having. She liked him. She wanted to know more about him. She'd begun to respect him despite his delusions. If she had to check him into a hospital, hold his hand and sit by his side until he recovered, she was going to do it. If she had to walk around Scotland for months, clutching a photograph of him until she found someone who could identify him and shed light upon his condition, she was going to do it. She tucked her bangs behind her ear and looked at him levelly. Her voice hardly shook when she said,
"Make love to me, Druston."
Mad or not, she wanted him to be her first lover, here and now on top of a mountain in the Highlands, beneath a million stars, encircled by ancient stones. Perhaps making love had some healing power. God knew she probably needed some healing, too. His eyes flared and he went perfectly still.
"I did hear that, did I not?" he said carefully. "You did say what I think you said, or have I truly gone as mad as you accuse me of being?"
"Make love to me,"
she repeated quietly. There was no tremor in her voice the second time. His silver eyes glittered.
"Lass, you honor me."
When he opened his arms, she leaped at him, and he swung her effortlessly into his embrace, pulling her legs around his waist. They both gasped at the intensity of the contact. A current of desire sizzled between them, zapping them both to the core. With powerful strides, he backed her to the perimeter of the stones until her spine rested against one of the megaliths. He lowered his head and kissed her, grinding his hips against her, and when she cried out, he caught it on his tongue.
"I've wanted you since the moment I saw you," he said roughly.
"Me too,"
she confessed with a breathless laugh.
"Oh, lass, why didn't you tell me?"
he asked, kissing her jaw, her cheeks, her nose and lashes, cradling her face with his hands.
"Why did you resist? 3 days we could have passed doing this.
he said, his burr thickened by desire.
Not if we wanted to get to your stones,
she panted, wondering why he couldn't just shut up and kiss her hard on the mouth.
Shut up and kiss me,
she said. He laughed and kissed her so hard that it unleashed ferocity in her tiny frame. She'd seen movies where people made love slowly, sinuously wrapping around each other, but theirs was a mating of wildness. Given their propensity to argue heatedly, she hadn't expected their sex to be anything less intense. She couldn't get enough of him. She wanted more tongue and more hands and more of his muscular ass. She wanted him naked against her body, wanted to feel him pounding into her. She'd waited all her life for this, and she was ready. Just looking at him made her wet. He tugged her shirt from her shorts and fumbled with her fly, kissing her urgently all the while.
Your trews, lass. Get them off, he said roughly.
I can't. My legs are wrapped around you,
she mumbled.
And, ow, your knife is poking my breast.
Sorry.
He nipped her lower lip and sucked it hard.
I must put you down, lass, to get you naked, and 'tis needin' you naked I am.